It's my pleasure to introduce our main speaker, Ed M. from Iowa.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and sponsorship, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink or a mood-altering chemical since January 5th of 1971, and for that I'm extremely grateful. And my home group is the Big Book Study Group in Davenport, Iowa. It's a small group, and we'd like to keep it that way. Thank you. It's a great group. We really love it. We kind of take things slow. We got through the first 164 pages. It only took us 4 years and 4 months. And because we actually, and we don't dissect it, but we do something a little different. You know, we share our experience, strength, and hope with what was read. It's not about dissecting it. It's about what does it talk about in my life and my sobriety. So I invite you to come and join us if you're ever in Davenport, Iowa at 6 p.m. on a Tuesday night. Or if you're depressed somewhere else, give us a call. You know, I want to thank Bob for the privilege of being at this meeting, being asked to speak at this meeting, and everybody that's involved. I've been out here a time or two, and I've always loved coming out here. And why I love coming out here is there is an enthusiasm with the people here that's not everywhere. You know, sometimes I hear people say, you know, AA's just great, just wonderful. Well, I go about every week somewhere, and AA isn't great everywhere. AA is really suffering in a lot of areas. So when you've got a group that's willing to take the actions and do that, it's really a wonderful thing, and it's really the heartbeat of Alcoholics Anonymous, in my opinion. Because I don't know what's happened in the last 10 or 15 years. It seems like people treat this more like a social organization than a way of life. And for me, my life depends upon my participation in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not just reading the book. You know, if you read the book a lot, that just proves you can read. You got to put into action what it says. And I never want to forget that. I was really pleased. Nobody had said anything about my height till I got to the house for dinner. And then some guy said, you get nosebleeds up there? You know. But, that's okay. That's okay. I did feel slighted. But it's always the same two questions, and it seems like it's by the same size person. First question is, Al, how tall are you? And I say, 6'10". They say, do you play basketball? And I say, no, how tall are you? And they say, 5'6". I said, you play miniature golf? It's, you know, seems fair to me, you know. They made up the rule. And I guess I've always been big for my age. In fact, I guess I still am. Any other 55-year-old, 6'10"? Well, still hanging in there. And, I know I'm 55 years old and 35 years sober. So if any of you are thinking you're too young, sorry. You know, it's always funny to me how people say, oh, we're so glad you got it so young. I mean, if we were cancer survivors, would we go into a hospital in the bed of a 16-year-old and go, oh, we're so glad you got it so young? No. No. I went to my first ANA meeting when I was 10 years old. I've got a brother sober 45 years in Newberry, South Carolina. He's so dry, we don't let people smoke around him, you know? And he took me to that ANA meeting, and I remember walking in there, and some old guy up here, about 20, 25, you know? Burnout, my name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic. The good for you, Fred, you know? Geez. I ever get old and burn out, I'll be here too. Well, I didn't know I was a prophet at that point. It took a while, But they lied to me. They lied to me in AA. You always say, no, nobody lied to me in AA. Well, they lied to me. They said, you know, if you keep drinking and doing that other stuff, you're going to die. And I thought, excellent. When? That never scared me ever from my earliest memory. In fact, my earliest memory is I was looking for a way out to stop the madness. I don't know about you, but I had voices going on in my head, and I had arguments from my earliest memory of what you thought of me and what they thought of me and what I thought of me. And I did something from a very early age that I did long time in sobriety. I could walk into a room of 300 people, 299 could turn around to me and say, Ed, you're the best. We love you. And one person could go, jerk. Guess who got my full attention? 2 weeks later, I'd sit up in bed going, what would the 45 bullet? I don't think so. And that story went all over the world. Oprah called me. 48 hours called me. 2020 called me. And they said, why'd you do that? I said, well, you see, it's step 8 and 9. If you're really working 8 and 9, you know, they didn't get it. But they didn't need to. I didn't do it for their applause. I didn't do it for their approval. I did it because it was the right thing to do. As God would have it, a few weeks later, I was up in that prison cell, and I reached out and I shook the hand of the guy I'd sat in front of court 28 years before, and I said, if you give me 5 minutes, we don't need a trial. And I shook his hand and I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum, and I'm here to tell you that I love you and I forgive you. And if there's anything in my life I can ever do to make your life better, please let me do that. And he looked into this old-timer's eyes, and he saw what I saw in the old-timer's eyes when I got here. I didn't quite get it, but I knew they were telling me the truth. I knew they were genuine, the real deal. And that's what I love about the people who've been before me in the Alcoholics Anonymous. They're the real deal. I don't get into their inventory because it's none of my business. Only inventory I know is they chopped down those weeds so I could see better. You know? And at the end of that meeting, we said a prayer, and they decided to retry him, and I went down to the county attorney, and who's a guy who loves and respects me, and he let him plead second-degree murder. And 2 years later, they released him into my custody. And I got to go up to prison and bring him home and get him a little apartment and buy him some clothes and get him a job. And when he was so terrified that he couldn't make it outside of maximum security prison, when the noises were so loud he just thought he was going to scream, you give me the ability to put my arms around him and say, you know, you can be a miracle too. I'm a miracle. You can be a miracle. We can do this a day at a time. You know, I don't know what's going on in your life, and my time's up. But I hope that you never forget the hope that's in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hope that if the shine has fallen off your sobriety, that we've polished it up a bit tonight. And I hope that you remember that the best is yet to come. I want to thank Bob for having me and you for allowing me to be in your presence. The only thing I would ask of you is you allow me to come back someday. Thank you. They say that, you know. Now, the problem with that is that's the only one of the group I remembered. Well, if you start collecting ones like that and you have a personality like mine, the bag of ones gets real heavy early on. So I thank God that I drank at a very early age. My father used to think it was funny for me to get drunk. He was a heavy drinker. I'm the youngest of 7 children. My father was one of the hardest working men I've ever known. I spent the first maybe 5 or maybe even 10 years in AA telling you how bad my parents were to me. And then I realized that the truth of the matter was that I was a parent abuser. I battled them at every inch of the way. I was 28 years old, 8 years sober. I went home to see my mother in Iowa. I had this big deal job all of a sudden, and I went home to see her, and I'm staying at their house. Now, I usually didn't stay at their house, but I stayed at the house, and I got dressed, and I'm going to a meeting, and I'm going out the door, and I'm 28 years old, been out of the house since I was 13, mind you. And you know what? Mom says, where are you going? And I'm thinking, none of your business. I'm a full-grown man. I'm going where I want to go, and that's what I'm going to do. But what I heard my mouth say is, to a meeting. You know what she said next? What time you're going to be home? And instead of saying, you know, I am 28 years old, I'm 7 feet tall, quit messing with me. I heard myself say, you know what, Mom, I'll be home about 10:30. And if I'm going to be later, I'll give you a call. You know what she had the nerve to say? Okay, honey. See, I'd been the instigator all those years. I rebelled at the motherly questions that need to be asked for her security. And it took me 28 years old and 8 years sober to get it. So if you got one of those moms like that, stop the arguing. When they're gone, they never come back, you know? I told you I drank at an early age. I fought. I had a bad temper. I was a cop fighter. Any other cop fighters here? Yeah, good. Any women? Oh, yeah, you dating anybody? No. I nothing like a good sick relationship. I promise to hurt you if you promise to hurt me. I But you know, the trouble with cop fighters is, and if you're a cop fighter and you decide to go out again, you might want to remember this. There's always more of them. Jeez. Who knew? Who knew? I never figured that out. And I just had a general bad attitude. And I had it when I was sober, too. You know, I hear people bad rap alcoholism a lot. But I was rotten on top of alcoholism. I had a bad attitude on top of alcoholism. I can remember one time that really bothered me, and the reason it bothered me is because it didn't bother me. And some of that will make sense to some of you. But I was in county jail, and I beat this guy almost to death, and I liked it. Didn't bother me at all. And I went, but the part that bothered me, I was sober. Stone cold sober. Had been in there a while. Hadn't done any of the local commodities. And there I am. There I am. You know, if you just think this is about drinking, you've got some more drunks coming. I am a firm believer that I have to work these steps in every area of my life. And any area that I don't will be the one that will eventually own me. There's a young lady, Lori, had 7 years sober and went to a doctor, and the doctor encouraged her to get on medications. She didn't stay sober long. She tried ODing on the medication several times, and then the psychiatrist fired her because she was too crazy for him. And she tried coming back to AA, and I talked to her a week ago tonight. She called me. Actually, she left a message. I didn't talk to her. She said, Ed, you know something? I need to get back in AA. I need God. I need to surrender to these steps. Will you come and see me Sunday? And that was my plans. And I spoke at a picnic or something up north in northern Illinois, and I was driving home, and I got a call, and Lori just couldn't take it anymore Saturday night and walked out in front of a semi on Interstate 80. You know, and I don't say that to make you sad. I just say that to... that we're in a battle for our lives here. And you better be taking some action to prevent that disease from taking over. You can sit there and talk all you want, but if you aren't doing things to make yourself better, the only thing I know we can do is get sicker. And they're going to have her memorial service tomorrow about 2. So tomorrow about 2, think of my little friend Lori, and especially your 8-year-old little girl who wonders where mommy went. You know? We live with the disease that we laugh and joke, and we have some wonderful times. But I don't ever want to forget that I won't see Lori smile much anymore. Don't want to forget that. January 5th of 1971, I got sober. I really didn't mean to. Wasn't in my Palm Pilot, wasn't in my day planner. It was just, you know... just one of those things. I was in a car accident. I was in car accidents a lot. James talked about that a little bit. And I was laying in the middle of the street, pretending like I was knocked out. It seemed like a thing to do at the time, And it was 18 below zero in Iowa, and the cops came up, and they said, "That's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth." And an amazing thing happened. I agreed. The fight was gone. The surrender had been made, and I didn't even know it. All of a sudden, it wasn't how I was raised. I used to jokingly say, you know, I come from a very elite group of people called white trash. And we worked hard to uphold our reputation. But what I need to tell you is that was an accurate description of exactly how I felt about me, even sober sometime. And, you know, I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that I got to surrender all the stuff. That's an old idea, that I got to surrender all the stuff. And the only way I know to do that is through the process of these 12 steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was laying there in the middle of the street, and the cops come up, as I said, and they took me up to the hospital, and they wheeled me by some nurse, and she said, "Ed, do you want me to call AA?" And I went, "Might as well." Now, us old-timers want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days, you know? And you know, that next morning, it came to mind about a year or two ago. James was talking about some of those, you know, I was a wine connoisseur, too. Anything that had a screw-on cap, I liked, and... Thunderbird, Mad Dog 2020, Ripple. My favorite was Ariba. Ariba was, it got a little pricey. It was up to 73 cents a quart. But if you held your nose, you could get it down okay. It was all right. And if you were a connoisseur of fine wines and anything else, and by the way, I am a big supporter of singleness of purpose in AA, but I also need to tell you that one statement you never heard come out of my mouth was, "What'll it do to you?" I didn't care. Got any more? Got any more? Oh, yeah, good. Let's try. You know, I was for it all. I was a pig. I was just a pig going in, and I based myself in alcohol. That's all there was to it. And I remember, if you do all that stuff, the next morning you get a little gift from time to time. It's called the dry heaves. Oh, aren't those good?
A little slobbered come off your lip. And you go...
You sit there for a minute and you think you're just about fine. You go to turn back toward the bed and there it'd come again. And about the time you tasted your toenails, you knew it was just about over. And I was wandering back toward my bed. And I got in bed and this guy from AA came in. His name was Hap, short for Happy. And he was from Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, "Hi, Ed, my name's Hap. I'm from A&A. And I thought, "Get out of my room," you know. But I didn't say that. He said, "We don't drink and we don't use, one day at a time." And I said, "You know what? I can't make it a whole day without something. Wish I could. I really wish I could. I can't make it a whole day without something." And he said, "Ed, all you have to do is try." And that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this. And that is my uninterrupted sobriety date, by God's grace. Because the one thing I knew is I didn't know the answers anymore. And I knew to keep busy. Thank God I knew to keep busy. I got busy, man. I knew if I stopped to think, I was in real trouble. And I remember I was a shaker. Any good shakers here? Yeah. Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they ruin it anymore. You get a new... Try to talk to a new person. They're no good at volleyball. In the old days, we were shakers. Just, "Jesus, how you doing, Ed? All good. How are you, man? Nice to see you. Cup of coffee? No thanks. Cup of chips in my teeth. Jeez, you know, just, and my arms would fly, and I just, man, I was just wired for sound. And I just had two rules. Don't come up behind me and don't touch me. Real simple rules, you know. And my little friend Harry didn't know the rules. Harry was as tall as he was big around, and he was the coffee pourer in my group. And Harry'd come up behind me, and he'd put his hand right here. And the minute he put his hand right there, a calmness came over me like I'd never known before. And I could hear, I could think, I could breathe. And the madness would stop. And everything was okay. And Harry'd pour my coffee slowly. And then he'd go and walk away, and I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. I didn't know what it was then. It's called unconditional love, by the way. Believe me, I was not a pretty sight when I came here. Had shoulder-length hair, wore tie-dyed motorcycle chains and a swastika around my neck because I knew it annoyed you. And I had a look. I had my look. You ever had, you have a look? I had a look that would back you up across the street. I lost it some years ago. I really feel bad about it because there's times when I wish I had it back. But I had a look, and I remember walking in a meeting one day with my look. And Logan in there, who died with 56 years sober, said, "How you feeling, Ed?" And I said, "Fine." He said, "Why don't you tell your face? It has no idea, you know." So there was a lot more things I had to change in Alcoholics Anonymous rather than just stop drinking. Thank you very much. Put the plug in the jug. That's an excellent start. But that's where my work began. And I had a lot of problems with a lot of things. I had a lot of ones in my life. And boy, I had a big problem with God. Don't even bring that crap up around me. We'd fight. And I mean to offend no one. It was simply my faith at the time, my faith that I professed and I believed with every fiber of my being, and that was God was a punk, and if he'd come down here, I'd beat the sheet off of him. And I wasn't saying it to be cute. I was not saying it to be cute. You see, I picked up a lot of ones about God. I was told that God was somebody that ripped people out of my life. My cousin Linda, when I was 10 years old, if there was anybody ever godlike, it was Linda. She did everything right. Had perfect hair, perfect grades, perfect everything. Couldn't stand her, but loved her, you know. But I kept comparing my insides to her outsides, and I always came up short, but I sure admired her. She was walking across the street, and a truck came by and hit and killed her. And I remember walking around the funeral home, and somebody said, "You know, God must have wanted an angel." And I thought, so he hits you with a truck. I'll pass. Yeah, I'll pass. You know what? Still will. Yeah, I'll still pass. And so I had all that about God. I had all the stuff about God, that God had ripped people out of your life and that he was out to get me, and I had a lot of ones. So imagine my surprise when I came to AA and they said, if I'm going to stay sober on a permanent basis, there it's an absolute must that I find a personal relationship with a God of my very own. I was a bit annoyed with that, because the God of my very own, the only reference I had was my bag of ones. But you gave me the keys to the kingdom there too. You told me I could come up with a God of my very own. So I thought long and hard about it. And I come up with a God that was kind and loving and forgiving. And I told him about it in the meeting. He said, how do you like that? And they didn't seem to mind at all, you know. But I got to tell you, that was 180 degrees from anything I'd ever thought about God before. God was just waiting to zap me. I was going to hell when I was 8 years old, and I knew it. And for a God to be kind and loving and forgiving was revolutionary to me. But I made a mistake right after that. I'd be around people in AA that would talk about God and the spiritual values of the 12 steps, and I started parroting the same things they'd say without the experience to back it up. Oh, they sounded wonderful, and I'd look into their eyes, and they meant it. But, oh, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. Nothing like a three-month sober guy telling a guy 20 years sober, did you pray about it today? Yeah. Now you can, you know. But I just started, and the only trouble with that is I am a firm believer, and it's been my experience, there will be a time in your sobriety that the only thing that will keep you from drinking or whatever else you're doing is a power greater than yourself. I was just a little over a year sober. My dad invited me over for dinner, which may not be unusual for you, but when my old man invited me for dinner, somebody was in trouble, and it was usually the invitee, you know. But you had told me if my family was going to change, it had to begin with me. I couldn't wait for them to shape up. I had to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to be a reflection of Alcoholics Anonymous. Let me ask you a question. If I went and asked your coworkers what kind of member of Alcoholics Anonymous were you, what would they say? How about your family members? You know, we come here and talk about how great we're doing. There's the evidence. There's the evidence. If you say you're a good member of AA, is there enough evidence to convict you? If not, you're going to drink. Because we can't think about this deal. We got to do this deal. I got to do this deal. I can't just read about it and think about it. I've got to put it into action. And when I see somebody that needs help, I need to help them, not pass it on to somebody else. That's what I've learned here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, Dad invited me over for dinner, and about halfway through dinner, Dad said, "Boy," and I thought, oh, here it comes. I said, "Yeah, Pop." I said, "Just want to tell you I'm proud of you." And I want to tell you something. They tell you when you get sober that miracles will happen, even if you think you already are one. And I'm all for that. I really believe that this is a room full of miracles. And people can say whatever they want about it, but they just aren't seeing through the eyes I'm looking, that's all. I really believe that. But my old man telling me he was proud of me, that would have never made my list of miracles. It just wouldn't, you see. You know, when I walked in the house that night, had you hooked a lie detector up to me and asked me if I cared what my old man thought of me, I'd say no, and it would have said true. I'm so grateful I was so horribly wrong about that and so many other things I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the nice thing here is when you find out you're wrong, you can become right now. You don't have to beat yourself up for 6 years. You can just change it right now. I am a firm believer. I am a firm believer more today than I've ever been in my life, that if you want to change your life, you got to change your mind and your actions. You got to. And for me, I got to change my actions, and my mind changes as a result of it. And that's been my course. And man, when my dad told me that, I don't know that I'd ever been prouder in my life. I went to a meeting afterwards and then went to my sister-in-law's house and got a call from my mother, who was crying and hysterical. And I said, "Mom, what's wrong?" She said, "Ed, come home quick. Dad went across the street to get a quart of beer. Him a quart of beer and me a bottle of pop. Now they're carrying bodies out. There's policemen everywhere. Please come home." And I'm thinking, well, I got God in my life now. Nothing bad can happen. And I'm driving across town. We had one of those Midwest ice storms where you got a quarter inch ice over everything. Took me a little while to get there, and I pulled up in front of that bar that I'd been drinking in since I was 11 years old. I never got carded, ever. And there were more policemen there than I'd ever seen in my life. And it's funny how those cops had shaped up that year I was sober, you know? Found out something. You aren't swinging at them, they usually aren't swinging at you. You aren't talking about their heritage, they aren't talking about your heritage. You know, it's really simple. And I'd been working in the courts that year. We had a wonderful rapport, Alcoholics Anonymous, with the court system, that if anybody came in and had a drug or alcohol problem, they'd just give them to us for 30 days, and the judge would say, "Bring him back in 30 days, or bring her back in 30 days. Tell us how she's doing or they're doing." And sobriety was great. People were getting sober right and left. It was just a wonderful, powerful time. Then, thank God, the professionals came in to help us. But during that time, I was in court almost every day. I was in court almost every day, so those cops knew me. So when I walked into that bar, there was a sense of respect there. And I, both ways, I had come to realize in one short year of sobriety, they are not my enemies. They are the people that protect me from people like I used to be. And I had a lot of respect for them. And I walked in there, and one of the officers said, "Ed, what are you doing here?" And I said, "My dad was in here." And he said, "Oh, my God." And I said, "Why? What's wrong?" He said, "Ed, all we can tell you is somebody came in and opened fire and shot everybody." And I looked down the bar and I saw a pool of blood with my father's glasses all smashed up and mangled in the middle of it. And I knew, but I didn't want to know. Some of you know what I mean, and if you don't, that's okay too. But I didn't need that information, and I sure didn't want that information. It's like September 11th when you turn on that TV and you turn it off because you don't want that information. You got to turn it back on. I'd always hoped and prayed that you wouldn't know that kind of heartache and sadness. And then September 11th happened, Oklahoma City happened, and everybody got a taste of what needless homicide is all about. And I turned to an officer, and I did an amazing thing. I asked my old arch enemy, I said, "What do I do? I have no idea." Because I was defenseless. I was defenseless. He said, "Ed, you need to go up to the hospital and see if your dad's up there. Some of them are alive, some of them are dead." So I went up there, and there was an officer up there that hadn't forgotten my past, and he was very unkind to me and said things that I won't repeat tonight and told me to get out of there before he had me arrested for obstruction of justice, that he had identified all the men in that bar, and my father wasn't one of them. We formed a search party, and we searched the streets for 10 hours because another officer friend of mine who spent the last 5 years of my drinking trying to put me away, I called him. Why? Because he was a straight-up cop. He could have gotten me 50 different ways, but he said, "I'll get you straight up, and when I do, you're going away a long time." And I used to say, "Everything's fair in love and war." That's the guy I called, and he's my dear friend to this day. And we came up with he was taken hostage or he wandered outside, something, so we formed that search party. 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer from the hospital called me up and said, "Well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. Why don't you come up and identify your father? Or your old man," is what he said. And I said, "Okay," and I got in my car, and I went up there, and I walked into that morgue, and I saw my daddy on that metal table with that bullet hole in his face, and there was a doctor here trying to tell me how the bullet went into the and exploded in the brain, and I just kind of looked at him and said, "I really don't need that information, thank you." And I reached for that faith I'd been professing and came up with a handful of nothing. Nothing. Except my kind and loving forgiving. A little bit of that was left. And I don't know that I've been more lonely or isolated or afraid ever in my life. But you know, God does for me what I could not do for myself. I didn't know what to do, so I went to go out of that morgue, and I opened the door, and there were members of AA and Al-Anon already there. Thank you, members of AA and Al-Anon. Because in their eye, they looked, and I knew that it was going to be all right, that I wasn't going to go through this alone. I had no idea what was going to happen. But I knew I couldn't feel the way I'd felt for 20 years. I knew that something had changed in me. One side of me was saying an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and if you mess with anybody in my family, you're going down fast. But your voices were louder, a little saying we have around here called live and let live. And that kept winning out. I was amazed. At the funeral, the guy who did the funeral did me a favor. He gave me one of the keys to the kingdom, too. He said, you know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will. He said, I don't believe that for a minute. He said, I believe God created human beings and gave us all a free will. Some of those human beings chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. And it was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. You mean God didn't kill Dad because of the way I'd behaved? I remember that from church. Whatever you do will come back on your family for generations. I remember that one. Don't remember all the others about forgiveness, but I remember that one. And when he said that, it just the weight fell off. Because I used to say, if there's a God, why are there starving children in the world? There's a real simple answer. We're busy adding on cell minutes rather than sending them a few bucks. Don't blame God anymore. There's more than enough. Cancer's rampant. Why is cancer so rampant? Because we pollute everything we touch and want to blame it on everybody else. Don't blame God anymore. This is his world. His heart's already broken. And then you want to blame him on top of it? Not my God. I came to believe that day, and I believe it even more today, that if it isn't good, it isn't God, simply. If it isn't good, it isn't God. I don't have a God that's teaching me lessons. I have a God that helps me learn from every experience. But I don't have I used to get tickled when somebody come into a meeting and say, oh, God's testing me. God's testing me. That's right. He stops the whole world just to screw around with your day. That's right. You're just that important, you know. My God doesn't test me. I test me. The world tests me. Everything about it tests me, but my God doesn't. Because he doesn't change like shifting shadows. He's good all the time. And that's my choice, and that's my decision, and that's my belief. And I'm real grateful for that. I got called in to testify against one of the guys, and I remember he was sitting there, and he had his little do going, and he was acting about halfway tough, and I thought, you know, why don't you just put him and I in a room for a while, and we won't need this trial. In fact, bring all five of the gangbangers in who think they're so tough as a group. Let me talk to them for a few minutes. That's what I thought, but what I did was more important. Because the people in AA said, everything you do is a reflection of AA, Ed, now. Everything that you do is a reflection of AA. When you go into that court, you behave yourself. And I thought, what an order. I can't go through with it. I'd never behaved in court, ever. But you see, I had something new. I had something I believed in. And it was you. Why? Because you were kind to me when everybody else wanted to lock me up. When I'd say bad words, you'd just say, Ed, we wish you wouldn't do that. And eventually I didn't do it anymore. You know, you were the ones that loved me back to health when I didn't know what love was. You were loved me when I had absolutely nothing to offer this world. You know, if you're just being kind to the people you like in AA, you're a hypocrite. You're just a phony hypocrite. Because it's the people you don't like that need the love and the help equally. Equally. Maybe even more than the ones you like. I was so grateful. I've had a sponsor now, same sponsor for 32 years. And I found out some years back that he didn't like me very much. And you know what happened about that? I respected him even more. Because I wouldn't have spent 5 minutes with somebody I didn't like. I respected him even more. That's called love, and that's called commitment and looking for my well-being. That's what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I sat through that trial, and those guys got convicted. I answered their questions, and I was pleased about that. I left there. God talked to me one day. Now, you got to be careful if God talks to you. Sponsors are good God filters. I urge you to use them. I went to my sponsor one time, told him I got a message from God. He said, oh, really, Ed? And I said, yeah, I did. And he said, well, you mind sharing the message with me? I said, no, I'll share it with you. And I shared it with him, and he said, you know, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting. And indeed it was. But I also got to tell you that 86-87 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous changed my life when I was 18 years sober and had lost everything. In those 3 pages, I found out how to live every second of every moment of every minute of every day and what to do if I get confused in the middle of it. On those 3 pages tells me everything I need to know. And it also tells me that I'm going to have a working relationship with God and a communication and be inspired. And years later, when God talked to me and I went to my sponsor and talked to him about it, he said, "You know what, Ed? I think God talked to you." And that's what I love about AA. That's what I love about AA is the encouragement, not the discouragement. The encouragement. And that's what I like about active groups. You know, there's going to be people take a lot of shots at active groups. They always are because they aren't doing anything except sitting at home judging you. You know? So, you know, when you hear an insult or when you hear a little put down, take it as a little badge of one for the good guys, one for God. They're sitting at home taking shots at you and you're out helping suffering alcoholic. I'm on your side every time. I'm on your side every time. But God talked to me and said, "Ed, go out to California, get into show business." I looked at my resume and it made perfect sense. So I jumped in my car and I went to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I got a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. Little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor, not going to many meetings. I was goofy, yeah. And I didn't actually start that job. I got the sponsor that I still have 33 years later now, I guess. And I went up to L.A., and there was this guy there in this group that was enthusiastic, and they were talking about living, and they were actually helping people, and they were feeding people, and they were housing people, and they were giving rides to people, and they were encouraging people, and I just loved that. And I asked this guy to be my sponsor. He said no, and I said, "Why not?" He said, "Anybody I sponsor has to look up to me, ha, ha, ha." And I thought, oh, cute. Good, tall jokes, that's what I need. And then he came up and said, "My name's Clancy. If you agree to do what I ask you to do, I'll be your sponsor." And I'm forever grateful that I didn't hear some of the things that go around about Clancy, even if they were true. You know why? You would have had a different speaker tonight. Because if I'd heard some of that crap, I would have never talked to anybody like that, ever. And I don't know about you and your sponsor, but Clancy was my Bill Wilson, as Bill was to Dr. Bob. He was the guy who made it clear to me. He was the guy who made that sing. He was the guy who everybody takes shots at who don't know what the hell they're talking about. Just want to take shots at it, sit back. But he saved more lives by accident than those people have on purpose. Why? Because of what he believes in Alcoholics Anonymous. Is he a perfect member? Nope. And are any of us? Absolutely not. My whole point is, I try not to judge anybody in AA. I may not like what they do. I may not like their group. I may not like anything about them. But I don't want to destroy your right to make that choice. So I try to keep the gossip to a minimum. And I'll tell you, if you're hanging around gossips, when you leave, you're the next topic. And this is a tough one. I get people mad. People get mad at me all the time, especially if they're the sponsor. If you're around a sponsor that gossips, be careful of what you confide in them. Because that ain't the example I want. That is not the example I want. We come here to uplift one another, not put down one another. I went to a meeting in Pasadena, California. I was going to talk out there. And at the end of the meeting, a guy walked up to me and said, "This makes no sense to me, but I want to offer you a job." I said, "Okay." And he said, "Have you ever been in show business management?" I said, "No." He said, "Have you ever been in overseas?" I said, "No." He said, "Be in my office Monday morning." So I showed up. That's what we do. We suit up and show up. I don't ask questions anymore. You told me I had to drop that bag of ones, that any preconceived ideas about the humanity or the human being that I used to be no longer was true because I'm a new person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe the book says that we are reborn. Now, I don't mean I drop my alcoholism somewhere, but I'm reborn as far as my nature and as far as my character if I follow these steps, suggested steps. So I showed up for the interview. That was on Monday. Thursday, I was lifting out of Los Angeles International Airport, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was new, soon to be vice president of America on Ice. I had a cast of 63 ice skaters. I was going over to Taiwan to negotiate with the government the building and the house, the ice skating rink and the housing arrangements while flying back and forth with designer Bill Campbell from here in Las Vegas, flying to Hong Kong to make the costumes. How was your week? Do you know what I was doing the week before? I was a laborer on a construction company. The only reason I tell you that story is God can change my life, but I got to let him. I got to let him. Toughest thing I had to do sober was walk toward the goodness. Misery's familiar. Character defects are familiar. Old ideas are familiar. What this program demands of me is to walk forward. It calls it walking in the sunlight of the Spirit. I kind of like that. And I remember getting off that plane in Taipei and everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me and I'm looking at them, you know. I know it's just a matter of time before they tie me down. And I was over there, and I don't have time to go into that, but I'll tell you what that situation did. It put me in a position to see talents and gifts that I had that I would have never believed I had. All of my life, people told me how talented I was. All my life, people told me how much potential I have. I'm sure there's others in the room. I got news for you. They're right and you're wrong. They've always been right and you've always been wrong, at least in my case. Everything they ever told me was absolutely true, but I had to get out of my own way to see it. It's called step three. If I don't turn it all over, will and life, you know, what more is there? What more is there? I talk to people all the time, well, I've turned it over, but I'm worried sick. How's that work? You know? How's that work? I don't know. But I'm over there, and I'm in Kaohsiung, and a guy walks by me and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I'm, yeah. And I got home to Los Angeles. 3 months later, the president of the Harlem Globetrotters called me up and said, we've heard wonderful things about you. Can you come in and talk to us? So much for my five-year plan, huh? So much for my destiny. Thank God I just went toward the light. And I went for that interview, and I ended up being road manager of the Harlem Globetrotters. And it was at a time when Metal Ark and Curly Neal were there. We spent a lot of time in Vegas here. All over the world we went, and I met kings and queens and presidents. And I never had one day of I didn't belong there. Do you know why I didn't have that one day? Because you told me I have the right to be wherever God puts me. I hear a lot of people say, I say, how you doing? They say, much better than I deserve. And I say, oh, God's still wrong, huh? No, you're getting exactly what you deserve because you're showing that kind of person. You're being the kind of person God always wanted you to be. Don't ever be ashamed of blessings. Why is it that we can't just say thank you? We always got to put it down. I remember one time Clancy taught me a wonderful lesson on thank you. I was broke and cleaning houses in Santa Monica, and he walked up and slipped me $5 to get something to eat. And as he walked away, I saw the $5. Oh, I can't take this. I can't. And Clancy, in his kind and loving way, said, shut up! Why don't you just shut up? Why does it always have to be about you? Why do you have to destroy the spirit of the giver? Why don't you just simply take it and say thank you and shut up? And I said, well, nobody's ever told it to me like that before. Explain it to me. And he is absolutely correct. When anybody is kind to me, I simply say thank you. I don't question your integrity or your ability to make decisions. When people do absolutely wonderful things in my life, I simply say thank you. And I don't destroy the spirit of the giver anymore because I don't have that right anymore. How dare I? I went back to Iowa at 18 years sober. I'd made some decisions based on self that cost me everything I owned. I was doing pretty good, not great, but pretty good. Had a little apartment, brand new apartment across from NBC Studios, and they got personal leave and took the Mercedes. And I went back home to Iowa, and I realized something had happened to me that I didn't, it wasn't even on the radar detector, and that's what I had and who I was became my God. And boy, I sure didn't mean it to, but it certainly had. And I got to start fresh. You know, that's the thing. If I got a message for you tonight, that's the message. No matter what you're going through, you don't have to drink. You don't have to relapse. Don't listen to that crap. You just got to surrender again. Start fresh. That's the deal here. We can start fresh anytime we want. And if you've been around and you're getting grumpy and life looks kind of crappy, start fresh. There's nothing wrong with starting fresh. because we just be current that way. At least that's been my experience. I came back to Iowa. I had a spiritual experience, very much like Bill Wilson had, and I can only tell you this, that it changed my heart from that and mind from that moment to this day. I am not the same man. And anybody who knew me before and after will tell you that same thing. I'm not saying that out of ego. I'm saying that out of gratitude, because it has absolutely nothing to do with me. And it has absolutely everything to do with the God I've come to believe in. And he said, I want you to work for me. And I thought, okay. And so within 2 weeks, I was pastoring a church. I'd never done it before, but it didn't seem that hard, you know. And I got an old bulletin, and I was doing sermons, and I was, you know, and I said, okay, what do you need to do? And they said, you need to go back to school, and you need to get your BA. I said, done, I'll do that. Went back, got my BA, and they said, now you got to get your little 96-hour master's degree. Master's of Divinity, done, did that, took me 7 years to do all that, become ordained, but I did it. And I never missed a meeting, and I never missed a commitment, and I never missed a day on my job. Because I've been given the right to participate in life today. I don't know about you. But if it's hurting for my friend Lori, who's passed, or celebrating the birth of a newborn baby, I am so pleased I'm present today. I am present no matter what's going on. I wouldn't trade it with anything or for anything. I was preaching one day on forgiveness, and I stopped right in the middle of my sermon because I realized that I had not told the guys who killed my father that I had forgiven them. And I said, I won't preach on forgiveness till I do that. 2.5 weeks later, one of the guy's sentence was overturned. I didn't even know he was on appeal. You want to know how well AA works? Now, you aren't going to believe this, but it's absolutely true. I forgot the names of the guys who killed my father. That's amazing. That's just amazing. I had them tattooed on my brain, and they were gone. One guy's sentence got overturned, and they came and talked to me, and I'm well-loved and well-respected in my community because of the way you've taught me to act. And they said, what do you think? And I said, well, let him come home. Let's start fresh. So, well, you know, he went in there when he was 17. He doesn't know how to work. Where's he going to live? And I said, he can come live with me if he'd like. And people were taken back by that, and I'm not sure why. Well, I'm really not. Look at what we were capable of. How dare us judge him? Given the right situation, the right attitude, or the wrong attitude, we'd swap places like that. Is driving a 3,500-pound bullet any less than shooting a